motion for compensation from Mr. Northrup and his firm, application for compensation from Cano Gates, one from Cascade, and from the trustees. So four compensation applications, and then as well as a motion for allowing and disallowing administrative claims, which I'm going to take at the end. Why don't we do this? I have a lot of questions, but I'm going to first let counsel speak in support of the applications and say whatever you all would like to say, and then I will raise my questions. So, Mr. Guerin, why don't I hear from you first?
Good morning, Your Honor. Michael Guerin, Cano Gates, representing the Chapter 11 trustee in this case. With me in the courtroom this morning, I have two of my colleagues, Dave New and Brian Peterson, have worked extensively on the case, and they're here to answer any questions you might have that relate to matters that they had primary responsibility for. Also, the trustee is here, as you know, and I think he's prepared to address questions as well. He's asked me to speak on behalf of both him. I'm going to consolidate all of the comments, and the hope is I'll speak on behalf of the trustee and also on behalf of his firm, the Cascade Capital Firm. I'd start off with this may not be the most difficult Chapter 11 trustee case ever in this jurisdiction, but it's one of them. It's one of the more hairy cases that I've ever observed in the court before. It has all kinds of complications to it and has not been an easy task to administer this case for any of the professionals that have been involved. The application amounts are significant. There are millions of dollars of fees that have been incurred in the administration of this case. And primarily to the detriment, frankly, of the professionals who will wind up suffering significant losses on the fees that have been incurred. The asset base of this case was inherently difficult. There were, you know, all kinds of troubled assets that the court has observed these kinds of things in the past, precious metals that the trustee was required to go and expend significant effort to secure, to ensure that those things were properly documented, locked down, and then accounted for. There were numerous and voluminous dies. There were issues about who the dies belonged to. There were voluminous records that required production from various parties during the course of the case and preservation of business records, claims being made to ownership over business records. And there were 3,000 creditors, and $83 million worth of claims that were filed in the case. The case is a complex business operation. The estate held an operating business that had more than 240 employees in seven locations across the country when the trustee took the business over. There were competing claims to the assets, to the ownership of the assets in the case, initially by the Medallic LLC entity and also by certain customers during the course of the case. And those caused significant strain on the resources of the trustee during the course of the case. There was extensive litigation in the case. There were nearly 2,000 pleadings filed in the court at this point. There's something 1,940 or 1,950 pleadings, I think, at this point in the court file. My offices have filed more than 580 pleadings to this point in the case. We filed 79 motions, five adversary proceedings. There were 15 litigation matters that were pending at the time the case was filed that the trustee had to resolve in the initial phases of the case. The trustee alone has more than 2,600 hours devoted to the case over 30 months. That averages out to about 86 hours a month. My firm has more than 7,000 hours of professional time devoted to this. Cascade has more than 5,000 hours of professional time that's been devoted to the case. From the outset of this case, there was only one possible avenue for recovery for creditors, and that was for the trustee to salvage, restructure, reorganize, and propose a reorganization plan for the debtor's business. On a liquidation basis, at the time the case was filed, this case was administratively insolvent. Everyone knew that. The creditors knew that, the creditors committee knew that, and the trustee knew that. The only path forward to try to bring any kind of a yield to the creditors who had lost significant amounts of value was to try to reorganize this debtor and have the business operations emerge, driving revenue, profit, and a sales value that could be achieved to pay the creditors something. So that was the mission that the trustee undertook. And he did that knowing that there was risk. He did that with the having made a detailed assessment of whether that was a reasonable task to go forward with. And he believed that that outcome was not just possible, but that it was he had a feasible way to go forward with that that possibility. He was supported in that by the creditors committee at every juncture along the way. In fact, I think it would be fair to say that the creditors committee urgently wanted him to come forward with a reorganization for the company's business because they knew that that was the only basis upon which there'd be a recovery here for creditors. There was risk. There was considerable risk in the ability to reorganize this business. There were some very strong headwinds that were involved in dealing with bringing this case forward and trying to have a business that would generate revenue to pay creditors. Well, the core business of the company produced quality products and had a strong workforce. But the business was in a state of disarray when the trustee took over this business. We've reported to you on a number of occasions the condition of the business at the outset of the case. Virtually no cash resources, no financial reporting, no cash flow management system, inadequate finance staff, besieged by pending litigation, overextended in multiple locations that it had, excess staff because there was no need to continue with a bullion operation. All of these problems that had to be dealt with in order to restructure the business and try to salvage it in a way that would provide value. But the trustees did undertake that difficult task, and they pressed forward with a number of initiatives to try to accomplish that. The task involved a complete overhaul of the debtor's business operations, consolidation of the minting capabilities in the date and location, hiring a new production manager and a new CEO, rebuilding the entire finance department, creating financial reporting and management systems, crafting a bankruptcy plan of reorganization. The focus of the professionals in the case for the first year of the case were all devoted to those efforts. Among the most significant obstacles we faced were the challenges to the ownership of the estate's assets by the Medallic LLC entity. And the court's well aware of the extensive litigation that went on in that adversary proceeding when Medallic sued the trustee and took the position that virtually all of the valuable assets of the manufacturing and production operations belonged to Medallic and not the bankruptcy estate. That issue had to be resolved as a predicate to any plan and a predicate to any ability to go forward with a reorganization of the debtor. The litigation was time-consuming and extremely costly. We know, we have confirmed that Medallic spent more than $400,000 of its money in that litigation. And it forced the estate to incur more than $700,000 in defending those allegations, including almost $200,000 in costs to preserve and protect voluminous records, produce those records during the course of the litigation, and to ensure that there were not going to be claims of spoliation directed to the trustee that would preclude the trustee from prevailing on his arguments that these assets did indeed belong to the bankruptcy estate. There have also been consistent efforts to undermine the trustee's ability to reorganize the business. And the trustee's been forced to expend significant resources to defend those as well. In the early months of the case, Ross Hansen, and I'm not going to belabor this point, Your Honor, I'm not going to belabor the Ross Hansen issues, but I am going to mention that Ross Hansen solicited an employee to sabotage valuable production equipment and attempted to persuade a number of employees to walk out, which would have crippled the business. There have been questions raised about the trustee's mechanism for defending this attack on the business, which was a contempt of stay motion, which was unsuccessful at the end. But the trustee could not sit idly by and allow the business to be compromised. He had to act in order to preserve the core goal of reorganization. A second consistent theme in this case has been a creditor clamor for an investigation of what happened to the precious metals that all the creditors expected were held by the debtor. There were more than $25 million worth of unfulfilled bullion orders in this case, and more than $13 million in missing storage, lease, consignment, and special order precious metals. And the trustee and his professionals expended an enormous amount of time to fully investigate these matters. The trustee did preserve and documented the preservation of all of the precious metals. He locked down the safes, he changed the keys and codes, and restricted access to whatever valuable materials were there. He's got photographic evidence, more than 3,000 pictures, and video evidence of his inventory of that precious metal that was on hand at the time of his appointment. There was a painstaking process for him by identifying precious metals that belong to storage customers and returning that storage inventory to those who could be identified as having inventory that was still on hand at the mint. And he returned more than $900,000 of storage and lease inventory to those customers. He then conducted, at the same time, and I think throughout, especially the early stages of the case, an investigation that he's called a fraud investigation. Aimed at seeking to uncover whether there were any missing metal that could be recovered for the benefit of creditors. And he did that through a number of mechanisms. He did that through some litigation efforts, some accounting efforts, going through the records of the business. He expended hundreds of thousands of dollars in furthering that investigation. And that was something that creditors were forcefully, uniformly, repeatedly telling him that they were extremely concerned about. Part of the Erdman Hansen litigation was directed towards that effort. And the depositions and the discovery that was undertaken in that case was in part intended to uncover evidence and to determine whether there were any other recoverable assets that were out there that may have been diverted from the mint. What I can say at this point is the trustee has now fully accounted for all the precious metal that was there and has exhausted any avenue that he believes for the recovery of benefit of metal for creditors. There are, and I think I've mentioned to you before, a possibility of a couple of avoidance actions in the tail end of the administration of this case that may be an exception to that. But in terms of, have we identified a body of precious metal that's out there that came from the mint, that has been diverted out of the company, that we could recover back for the creditors, despite all of our efforts to do so, we are not aware that there is any such pocket of assets out there that can be recovered. The trustee, parenthetically, the trustee, I think this question has been raised, the trustee did explore whether there were insurance coverage options for the benefit of creditors, and we discussed those issues with the Unsecured Creditors Committee. We actually spent some time, and you'll see time in our K&L Gates application, where we brought in insurance coverage professionals to actually analyze those policies. And unfortunately, what we discovered is there really was not a policy, notwithstanding some of the contracts that the storage customers had. There was not a policy that would cover the losses of those storage customers. There have been questions raised by some regarding the time that the trustee expended with working with the FBI in the case. The federal government in this case issued approximately 10 subpoenas. Those subpoenas were detailed, lengthy, and caused the trustee to have to go search through voluminous records to comply with those subpoenas. There were follow-up questions that the FBI came and asked him about the materials. There was an extensive amount of time that was devoted to responding to those lawfully issued subpoenas from the federal government. And the trustee had a legal obligation to comply with those subpoenas, and he did so. So a couple of watershed moments in this case. I mean, one, I think, is in the spring of 2017, and we reported to the court that the trustee became alarmed when he had in April or May, he had operating results that were way out of line with what he was expecting. And that gave rise to serious concerns about cash flow, ability to maintain the company through the upcoming season in order to preserve the value that was there. We had retained a CEO, Mr. Atala, who had was advising us regarding the ability to grow sales, but that sales growth was not materializing. And given that, the trustee's focus at that point shifted to trying to sell the company. And throughout the summer of 2017 and into the fall, the trustee devoted enormous effort to try to market the company for sale, solicit interest, creating a database. And he, as he put it, kissed a lot of frogs. He went around and talked to a number of potential suitors for the company, trying to solicit interest, trying to get an offer to buy the company as a going concern. And the sales prices that people were discussing were, you know, $6 to $10 million. So there was not insignificant value that was still on the table at that point. So that's really what was occurring through the fall of 2017. We did have a written offer from a buyer in the fall of 2017 that eventually fell through. And once that process had been exhausted and we did not have a viable buyer, the trustee had no choice but to close the business in December of 2017. Since that time, the focus of the case has been on the liquidation of the assets of the estate. The assets were liquidated through a series of Section 363 sales. Those sales were themselves complicated. There were some difficulties involved in completing some of those sales. There were multiple parties expressing offers. There were issues about ownership of some of the assets, including the dies. There were issues about dealing with records and so forth that had to be resolved. The end result at this point is that the case has nearly been fully and professionally administered. The vast majority of the assets have been liquidated. All the secured claims have been administered and paid. The ordinary course administrative debt has all been paid. And all the filed administrative claims have been addressed with the motion we have before you today, which I will tell you I think is consensual at this point, if that makes a difference to the court in terms of whether you want to take that up earlier or not. But I think that the issues with the motion to resolve the administrative claims, if the court rules on that motion, I think we will have fully administered all filed administrative claims in the case. The compensation, the standard here for awarding compensation is whether the compensation is reasonable compensation for actual necessary services, and whether the costs are actual and necessary expenses, Section 330 of the code. And the case law makes it clear that the focus of whether the services are reasonable and necessary is on not on actual results, not on looking back retrospectively and determining whether there was some monetary benefit from the services that were provided that's tangible. But looking at it, whether those services were reasonably likely to benefit the estate at the time they were rendered. And I cite to the course the case that we put in our materials, In re Smith, 317 F3rd 918, Ninth Circuit case, 2002. I think the thrust of those cases, of that case and others, is that this is not a Monday morning quarterbacking 2020 hindsight perspective to look at whether there was an actual monetary benefit conferred. It's to examine it from the perspective of when the services performed at the time and to determine whether those services were necessary or beneficial and that they were likely to result in some kind of benefit, whether they're tangible or not, to the estate. Services that are rendered in the administration of the case are compensable, not just pursuing a plan. It's not necessary, I don't think, that a plan has to be confirmed. I know one of the cases, the Stecker case that was cited in the committee's materials, had a suggestion that, you know, if the plan wasn't confirmed, that maximum results hadn't been achieved and that therefore there was some issue about whether compensation should be awarded. But I will tell you, the Stecker case, I think, is unusual. It was a case where a Chapter 11 trustee, I believe, was asking for a fee enhancement above his hourly award and asking for a maximum cap amount, notwithstanding the fact that he had incurred hourly rate fees at a lesser amount. And that is not what's happening here. The bankruptcy trustee here has incurred more than $1 million in hourly rate fees and is capping those fees at $906,000. Now, we did have fee applications before you in October of 2017, Your Honor, and we listened to the concerns that you had raised. We actually went back and pulled the transcript, and we went through the specific issues that we raised, and we sought to address those in these fee applications. In particular, what I can tell you is one of those issues, whether you talked to Mr. Calvert about whether there was time buried in the Cascade application for his time that really was more appropriately characterized as trustee time. And what I can tell you is the trustee did move considerable portions of the fees from his Cascade time bucket into the trustee bucket and wrote off expenses and other time that he thought was appropriate to do so. Mr. Calvert did perform valuable services under his role with Cascade, not just his role as the trustee. And his acting as a participant or a professional providing financial services to the estate was always anticipated in this case. It was actually part of the original understanding when we initially talked to the U.S. Trustee's office about him taking the engagement. It was part of when we sought his employment before the court, we noted that there was a specific need for financial services in this case, and that Mr. Calvert would provide those by his company, Cascade. Mr. Calvert reduced his rate for the Cascade services significantly, but he provided specific services in terms of supervising many of the financial reporting, creation of the financial reporting tools and financial management tools with his staff. He provided considerable support for analyses relevant to the formulation of the plan, provided personal support in connection with financial analyses used in the marketing of the company and its assets, and he testified before the court as a financial consultant with respect to litigation matters. So what I can tell you is there with respect to the Cascade application, this case was a heavy user of financial services, in part because the debtor's operations had an inadequate financial staff, had an inadequate, there was no CFO at the company. There was a controller there. And the financial reporting materials were so inadequate they had to be rebuilt. And the only way to do that for the trustee to do that, especially under the strained cash flow concerns that the estate had, was to bring his staff in to do those tasks. As a trustee, Mr. Calvert has a proven track record in this district. He's properly managed highly complex and difficult Chapter 11 engagements before this court over the period of the last 7 or 8 years. There are few trustees who could have taken this engagement and performed it. Mr. Calvert is one of the very few who had the skill set to come forward and to manage such a difficult case. Mr. Calvert, his firm, and the other professionals in the case have taken on an enormous financial risk trying to bring a return to creditors in this case. We recognize the court has expressed some concerns and criticism of the trustee in the case. We've sought to address each of those through additional declaration evidence we've submitted to the court in the last couple of months. We've done our very best to try to submit everything that we thought that the court had, had expressed a concern about. And we're happy to address any other concerns the court may have here this morning. There is a current of background noise in this case with letters that are being submitted to the court from various parties. There are a select very few, a handful of actual creditors in the case that have filed letters in the court of the 3,000 creditors involved who have put frankly untrue, unfair, and defamatory accusations into the record. There's also a blogger that has submitted a number of records, and I think I've said in our materials, those materials are flat out false, baseless, and without any foundation. They should not be considered by this court for any purpose in the case. I think it would be completely improper to do so, and we've asked the court to strike those letters from the court record.
Which letters are you talking about? Are you including Hansen and Pell's letters?
No, the ones I'm talking at this point, Your Honor, I'm talking Gibbons. About Mr. Gibbons' letters.
Yeah, I'm not considering his letters. He's not a creditor. He has no standing.
All right, thank you, Your Honor. As a practical matter, of course, depending on what the court does with respect to the motion we have to dispose of the additional administrative claims. We've resolved all the other administrative claims, and our intent has been to try to be treat all those administrative creditors and pay them more fairly than the professionals are going to be paid, but to get them, get their claims administered and get them out of the case. And what will be left in this case will be the professional claims that will be unpaid. The remaining true parties in interest in the case actually are the professionals in terms of who will wind up with whatever residual amounts of money are left in the bankruptcy case. The trustees never received any payment of compensation in this case, not a dollar, over more than 2.5 years. He's going to face significant discounted payment on his fees regardless of the amount that the court allows. The Cascade firm received roughly $110,000 2 years ago, but refunded $100,000 of that money in order to assist the cash flow concerns of the bankruptcy estate. So they've received roughly $10,000 in compensation in 2.5 years. My firm has not received a payment on the case since December of 2016, 2 years ago. I think it's also important to note that we knew that this case was seriously administratively insolvent in December when the business operations had to be shut down and we had to abandon any opportunities to sell the company as a going concern. But the professionals in the case have not abandoned the case. We have not walked away and left the remaining tasks in this case unperformed. And my firm and Mr. Calvert's firm and Mr. Calvert as the trustee had devoted about $1 million of additional fees into the case since the beginning of the year. I think there's a tradition in this district and really across the country for fairly treating trustees and for supporting their business judgment and for recognizing the difficulty of the job that they do and the energy that they put forth in administering what are commonly very difficult projects. This has been one of those difficult cases. The trustee in this case has made extraordinary efforts to try to achieve a return to creditors. He devoted thousands of hours of his time, his expertise, his financial resources to this estate to accomplish the administration of this case. He's refunded fees paid to Cascade to support the estate. He's expended, advanced other costs on behalf of the estate. He will, on the Cascade application, will recognize an actual loss based upon the amount of time that he's expended in paying his employees at the Cascade level, regardless of how much the court might award in fees here today. I think the trustee's efforts need to be recognized in this case, and I think it would be an injustice for the trustee to be unfairly criticized, heavily criticized, for what's happened in this case. This trustee has given his all to try to make this case work for the benefit of creditors. Has he made mistakes? Have things happened? Have there been inaccuracies? There have. I don't think that's that unusual in something this complex. But I will tell you that there's no possibility, allegation that could be supported that this trustee has ever done anything to further his own interest to the detriment of the creditors in the case, or to do anything but to properly administer the assets and try to secure them and try to bring a result into the case. I think he's done his very best to do as professional a job as he possibly can in the case. The professional in this case are going to take a heavy discount regardless of the amount the court awards. And as a practical matter, it's only the professionals that are going to bear the consequence of whatever amount of fees the court allows. What I can tell you is that K&L Gates consents to the allowance of the committee counsel fees and costs, the trustees' costs, and the costs of Cascade in the amounts requested. And I'm authorized to tell you that the trustee and Cascade also so consent to the allowance of the fees of the committee and K&L Gates as requested. There's a limited remaining administration in this case, Your Honor. There's some store inventory that we need to come forward and make a proposal to you on the resolution of that. The trustee is currently fielding some offers for some residual assets that are left in the Northwest Territorial Mint. He has had some folks approach him on purchasing some of these residual assets. There's the sheriff's seized inventory that I've mentioned to you before. And there's some of these avoidance actions that I've also mentioned. So it's a very limited amount of additional work that needs to be done. I think I've told you before, the trustee's intention is to try to wrap this case in the first half of next year. We did have a discussion at the last hearing I was in front of you on whether there should be a conversion of the case. And I think our preference would be not to convert the case, but to do a structured dismissal, as the court had suggested when we brought the conversion motion before you earlier this year. At October month end, the trustee held $2.389 million in unencumbered cash in the case. With the Warren Act settlement that you approved yesterday, and I thank you for that, and the settlements of the other administrative claims that we are proposing in the motion we have before you today, we would be distributing about $180,000 to pay those claims off. And the trustee is proposing to pay $2 million of unencumbered cash out in pro rata distributions to the professionals who are seeking compensation here today based upon the amount of the allowed fees that you award. This would leave about $200,000 in the estate to complete the remaining administration, which the trustee believes is adequate. Your Honor, I know this has not been there have been frothy waters in this case along the way, and it's been a long haul. We're not at the end of the road in the case, but we can see it from here. But I do respectfully submit that in the circumstances of this case, the fees that we have applied for are reasonable and necessary. And I request that the court allow the fees and costs as applied for, and authorize the trustee to distribute the $2 million in unencumbered fees to partially satisfy those fees.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Appreciate your comments. What I'll do next is I'll hear from Mr. Northrup, and if you can speak in support of your own application, and then you're the aside from creditors, you're the only party that has filed any opposition to the other professionals. So I'll hear from, if you could merge your comments as well as part of your presentation. Then I'll hear back from you, Mr. Guerin, to response from Mr. Northrup. I am going to then, I will hear the admin claims motion before I get to my questions on the fees, because I see Mr. Ferris is here, Mr. Bailey's here. I don't know if they're planning to stay throughout all of it, but I assume they're here on the admin claim motion, so if I can get that resolved, you'll then be able to go. So, but I will hear from you first, Mr. Northrup.
Good morning, while it's still morning.
Yes, good morning for a few more minutes.
Mark Northrup, Miller, Nash, Graham & Dunn, counsel for the Unsecured Creditors Committee, and obviously appearing also today on behalf of my law firm. Back in October, I filed my law firm's applications for fees in this case in the amount of $384,137. And I titled my application, final application, running through October 15. I have no intention of requesting fees beyond that date, despite the fact that I've expended thousands of additional dollars in responding to the fee applications that are currently before the court. Just as a threshold matter, I believe that no objections to the allowance of my fees were filed. A small number of individuals filed letters lodging various complaints about the case and its professionals, including me personally, but none of those submissions presented specific analyses or legal arguments about any of the specific applications currently before the court. I don't believe that the fees of my firm are controversial at all. My fees represent a very small portion of the professional fees before the court today. By my calculation, only about 6.9%. As described and identified in my application, all the services performed by committee counsel were rendered in accordance with the powers and duties delegated to committees by Bankruptcy Code 1102B3 and 1103C. All of committee counsel's services in this case, as the Spanger Court described it, quote, promoted the bankruptcy process or administration of the estate in accordance with the practice and procedures provided under the bankruptcy code and rules for the orderly and prompt disposition of the bankruptcy cases and related adversary proceedings. I did file a fairly lengthy response to the fee claims of the trustee and the trustee's accountants and trustee's counsel. That was docket 1943. I filed this response for two primary reasons. First, to provide the court with a sense of the attitudes of some members of the committee to the professional applications. Second, and in my mind no less important, to give the trustees' professionals the opportunity to establish a record in reply to my response and to creditor criticisms. I believe the trustees' professionals have taken this opportunity and in their replies have filed multiple declarations and documents addressing these issues. In my response, I identified a number of fee concerns that I would typically raise in the fee application process in a case in which the allowance of fees was going to have an economic impact on general and secured creditors. Here, however, that is not our case. The applications say unequivocally that the case is administratively insolvent and that only administrative priority creditors will receive a distribution, only fractional, on their allowed claims. Under these circumstances, the pending professional applications create a zero-sum structure in which the reduction or disallowance of one professional's fees will only serve to increase the funds available for payment of other professionals. This reality creates, in my mind, an extremely awkward economic conflict of self-interest between the professionals. Both I and my law firm find this conflict, frankly, distasteful. And as a bottom line, neither I nor my firm seek to ask the court to disallow or reduce the professional applications from their filed face amounts. All the professionals and their firms in this case are taking substantial economic hits on their ability to obtain compensation in this case. And the reduction of one professional's claim will serve only to reallocate that amount to the partial payment of another professional's claim. This is ultimately a pointless exercise with de minimis effects given the pro rata amounts available. A mere rearrangement of a few of the proverbial deck chairs on the Titanic. As the trustees' counsel has indicated at length preceding me, this was a difficult case with some difficult issues and some very difficult people. The trustees' reorganization failed, but I do not believe that it failed because the trustee abused his statutory power to pursue major case objectives in accordance with his business judgment. Moreover, in the exercise of the trustee's business judgment, the trustee's professionals advanced over $5 million worth of professional services in what I believe was a good faith effort to make the case succeed. In return for their efforts, these professionals are going to suffer millions of dollars in business write-offs, losses that exceed virtually every individual creditor claim filed by a creditor in this case. Finally, criticisms and personal attacks are the product of angry, disappointed, disgruntled creditors in this case who were victimized by Ross Hansen. I believe their criticisms are unfounded, but the committee actions they, in my case, purport to expose played no part in the failure of this case. As Mr. Guerin recognized this case, and as I certainly recognize, this case died in April 2017 when the business experienced a $242,000 operating loss in a month that had historically been significantly profitable. The reorganization could never recover from this loss, but there was certainly no relationship whatsoever between the April loss, the ensuing failure of the business, and the actions of the committee or its professionals. I will stand by for your question, Jerry. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Northrup. As I said, I'll hear from Mr. Guerin if you like to respond to what Mr. Northrup said with respect to your and your clients and Cascades fee applications.
I don't think I have anything to add to Mr. Northrup's comments.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Guerin. As I said, I'm going to change course because I do have two lawyers who I think are here on the admin claims motion. Mr. Bailey, are you here to be heard on that, or just to observe?
I'm here to observe.
All right.
And to answer any
okay.
questions if the court has.
All right, thank you. And Mr. Ferris, you're up at council table, so you're here as well. Let
yep.
me turn to that motion so we can resolve that, and then Mr. Bailey and Mr. Ferris may leave if they wish. So this is.